This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence, including against children, that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
55-year-old Ed Ray lived a simple, uncomplicated life as a farmer and part-time school bus driver. He'd never sought out adrenaline-filled, life-or-death situations.
And yet, in the early hours of July 16, 1976, three masked gunmen were putting him in one. With 26 school children in his care, they were forcing Ed to stand strong and be a hero.
Facing his captors in a canvas enclosure, Ed wanted to be brave. He wanted to know who these men were, what they wanted from him and the kids.
But once one of the men stuck the shiny barrel of a gun in his face, Ed's resolve disappeared. He did as his captors ordered and took off his pants and cowboy boots.
When the men ordered him into a hole in the ground, Ed begged them to spare his life. He just wanted to see his grandchildren again, but his pleas fell on deaf ears. Staring down the gun, he climbed down the ladder. He would stay calm for the children, even in the face of death. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
This is our second episode on the kidnapping of 26 elementary school students and their bus driver by three ordinary young men on July 15, 1976.
Last week, we got to know the town of Chowchilla and 55-year-old bus driver Ed Ray. We also met the three kidnappers, Fred Woods, Jim Schoenfeld, and Rick Schoenfeld, and delved into the motives and meticulous planning that led them to that July afternoon in 1976.
This week, we'll follow the hostage situation as Ed and the children waited underground, unaware if anyone was even looking for them. We'll dig into how law enforcement handled the case and find out what happened when an unexpected event changed everything.
After nearly 11 hours trapped in stiflingly hot darkness in the back of two vans, Ed Ray and the 26 children in his care felt the wheels come to a stop. But as desperate as they were for fresh air, Ed and the kids were terrified of whatever awaited them outside.
Ed was sure the men were going to kill them all one by one. As the biggest threat, it was natural that they asked for him to come out first.
The kidnappers unlocked the door from the outside, barely opening it far enough for Ed to squeeze out. The children, too terrified to move, didn't dare look through the door to see what was going on.
Ed expected to be hit with a blast of fresh night air, so he was surprised to step out into what seemed like a tent. Once his eyes adjusted to the dim light, he saw that several tarps had been strung up around the vans. He looked around, hoping to find some clues as to where they were, but all he saw was the dirt under his cowboy boots and, a few steps away, a ladder sticking out of a hole in the ground.
And of course, the two men facing him, stockings still pulled over their faces. One carried a flashlight, the other a gun. Where the third man had gone, Ed didn't know. The men demanded to know his name and age, and then they told him to take off his shoes and pants.
Ed was confused, but the man with a gun pointed it at him, and Ed didn't dare disobey.
Then, the other man gave Ed a flashlight and some batteries and ordered him to go down the ladder. For the first time, Ed protested. He begged the kidnappers to let him survive to see his grandchildren again.
But the two masked men didn't even respond. Ed knew he didn't have a choice. He climbed down the ladder wearing only his shirt and underwear.
As he disappeared into the hole, Ed heard the van door open and one of the children get out. He knew that if he climbed back up, he might be killed. Reluctantly, he continued down the ladder. Once he reached the bottom, Ed turned the flashlight on and scanned it around the dim, candlelit space. He was in what looked like the trailer of a freight truck. It was already starting to cave in from the dirt pressing in all around it, but the walls had been reinforced with wooden beams.
There were a bunch of old mattresses spread around, as well as some nourishment: sliced bread, peanut butter, breakfast cereal, potato chips, and 5 jugs of water. Somewhere nearby, Ed could hear fans whirring, but he couldn't see them.
Ed didn't know whether to be relieved or more scared. On the one hand, the men above didn't seem to be planning to kill them immediately. But on the other hand, there definitely wasn't enough food for 27 people to last very long.
Above ground, Fred, Jim, and Rick were taking kids out of the vans one at a time. Like Ed, each child was asked their name and age and forced to hand over an item or two. Some had to give the men their toys and books, others sweatshirts or shoes. And then each child was sent down the ladder.
The process was repeated until there were only 2 children left: 14-year-old Mike Marshall and 5-year-old Monica Artery. When the door opened again, Monica clung to the older boy, terrified. Mike didn't know what to do. He couldn't send Monica to her death, but he couldn't leave her by herself with the kidnappers. He didn't have much time to think. The masked men demanded that one of them get out immediately.
Mike steeled himself. He'd go first. Well, maybe he could fight them off and keep them from taking Monica.
Mike made the choice most people would. According to medical research, humans are more likely to sacrifice themselves rather than cause physical harm to someone else.
Of course, Mike's moral conundrum was irrelevant. When he was sent down the ladder and saw the others still alive, he breathed a sigh of relief. They were all safe, at least for now.
Once everyone had climbed down, the kidnappers pulled up the ladder and threw down a roll of toilet paper. One of the kids started to cry, asking Ed how long they were going to be in there. From above, the men called down that it would be a day or two, but they promised that they'd be back. And then, a metal plate clanged into place over the hole, sealing the exit.
Unbeknownst to the captives, the 3 men had secured the plate with a couple 100-pound industrial batteries, put a box over it, and covered it with dirt. Escaping would not be possible.
As Ed and the 26 students listened to the faint sounds of the vans driving away, it hit them. They had just been buried alive.
Coming up, we'll find out what the 3 kidnappers were planning for their hostages. Now, back to the story.
It was around 3:30 a.m. on Friday, July 16th, 1976. 24-year-old Fred Woods, 24-year-old Jim Schoenfeld, and 22-year-old Rick Schoenfeld pulled away from the place where they buried their 27 hostages alive. Little did their captives know, they'd been imprisoned underneath a quarry owned by Fred's father. They were in Livermore, California, about 100 miles from home.
Well, so far, everything had gone according to plan. They'd confused their captives by driving around for nearly 11 hours before stopping. They'd been careful not to speak too much so their voices wouldn't be familiar. When they arrived at their destination, they'd written down the names and ages of all the hostages and taken personal items from each of them to prove that they were telling the truth when demanding the ransom. As they drove away, Fred and Jim were feeling pretty good. Rick had been spooked by the crying children and the bus driver begging for his life. But since Fred and Jim didn't seem to be bothered, he didn't say anything.
Because the whole thing had started as a hypothetical thought experiment, they were mentally removed from the emotion of the situation. The fact that everything had gone smoothly up to this point only further emboldened them. Now, the three kidnappers remained laser-focused on the task at hand. The next step was to get to a payphone and call in their ransom to the Chowchilla police.
But the kidnapping hadn't gone quite as smoothly as they thought. Back in Chowchilla, the police had already been on the case for hours. About an hour after Fred, Jim, and Rick hijacked the bus the previous afternoon, parents started to get worried. By 4:35 p.m., the school superintendent, Leroy Totem, was notified.
Leroy was in a nearby town for a meeting, but he raced back to Chowchilla and drove Ed's bus route, expecting to find the bus broken down somewhere. Rules dictated that the driver wasn't allowed to leave the kids in any circumstances, and Ed was a stickler for the rules.
When he didn't find the bus, he went to the town's auto repair shop. Perhaps Ed had managed to get the bus towed there, but there was still no sign of Ed, the kids, or the bus.
Around 5:40 p.m., a parent called the Madera County Sheriff's Department. By 6, the Chowchilla police also got in touch with the sheriff's office. They'd received a number of calls from parents about the bus never having dropped the kids off.
Well, this was obviously more than a few overzealous parents working themselves into a panic. It was time to get the squad cars out searching.
Retracing the bus route, the officers quickly ran into Leroy, who brought them up to speed. By going door to door along the route, they figured out approximately when and where something must have gone wrong. By 7 p.m., two search planes were in the air. Nearly every local with a car and a CB radio was combing Chowchilla and the surrounding area for any sign of the missing bus.
Around 8 p.m., one of the search planes spotted something in a dry creek bed, hidden by the bamboo groves. Within 10 minutes, law enforcement had found the bus. It was empty and there were no footprints, but there were two sets of tire tracks leading back to the road.
The officers still had no idea what was going on, but their best guess was that it must be a kidnapping, which meant they could contact the FBI. And as soon as they called the nearest field office, it was run up the pole to Washington, D.C.
Before long, President Gerald Ford and his Justice Department were sending resources to investigate the mass abduction. So, too, was California Governor Jerry Brown. And with the politicians came the press.
Within hours, journalists from major national newspapers, radio stations, and TV networks had descended upon the small farming town along with over 50 FBI agents. As the officers tried to make sense of a crime with few clues, every step of the story was broadcast across the country.
Before long, calls were pouring into the Chowchilla Police Department with possible leads. This may have done more harm than good for the small department. Even though tips were coming in from as far away as Massachusetts, they had to follow up on every one.
These developments were occurring around 3:30 a.m., about the same time that Fred, Jim, and Rick drove away from the quarry. Before they placed the ransom call, they had to put some distance between themselves and the hiding place, just in case the police could track where they called from. So they headed back home to regroup.
In the meantime, the newly abandoned hostages were panicking. They had no way of knowing if their kidnappers had been telling the truth when they said they'd be back in a day or two. The thought of being left to die in this underground prison was terrifying.
But even in this frightening situation, some of the kids still had an appetite, and ate a bit of the meager food rations. Most of them drank some water. But it was 4 a.m, and they were all exhausted, both emotionally and physically.
Ed tried his best to help them relax. Getting as many of the kids to sleep as possible would help keep things from getting out of hand. But he was wrestling with his own panic, too, and it was hard to be reassuring. Some of the older kids tried to calm the younger ones by singing songs they all knew.
This was one of the best things they could have done. According to research by doctors Marianne D. Judd and Julie Ann Pooley, group singing has long been recognized as a stress relief tool. Not only does it decrease levels of cortisol, the hormone connected to stress, but it may even help release endorphins. By singing together, the kids were naturally calming themselves and each other down.
And it worked. Soon enough, most of them had managed to doze off, giving themselves a temporary reprieve from the waking nightmare.
By the morning, the story of the 26 missing children was breaking news across the country. No one believed that an entire school bus could simply disappear, but that's what seemed to have happened. Parents around the U.S. suddenly found themselves wondering if their child's school bus could be next.
What was most disconcerting was that even by 7 a.m. Pacific time, there had been no ransom request. No call, no letter, nothing. As far as anyone could tell, Ed and the kids had been taken for no apparent reason at all.
With no concrete information to go on, outlandish theories began to spread. Parents became convinced the police weren't giving them more information because they didn't want to tell the families they'd already found the bodies. California news outlets reminded people that several years earlier, the still-at-large Zodiac Killer had threatened to kill a school bus full of kids. Some people called the police with theories about grand international conspiracies, while others blamed their own friends and family members.
The police even briefly thought that the kidnappers might be junkies, since an officer found what looked like used drug paraphernalia in the field near the bus. But again, the lack of ransom demand stymied them. Surely anyone looking to use the kids for money would have gotten in touch by now.
What they didn't know was that Fred, Jim, and Rick had tried to call the Chowchilla police to state their demands, but they hadn't been able to get through. The phone lines were so jammed with leads, most of which were false or useless, that the kidnappers themselves couldn't get in touch.
It was frustrating, but they reassured themselves that the captives would be fine for a while. If it took a few more hours to get the ransom process going, it wouldn't be a problem. So the three exhausted and exhilarated young men did what felt like the most reasonable thing to do. They went back to Fred's apartment to sleep. After all, once they got in touch with the police, things would move quickly. They'd want to be rested and sharp for the negotiations.
But the tide was slowly turning against them. Back in Chowchilla, the investigation was creeping forward, despite the myriad of false leads slowing them down. By mid-morning on Friday, July 16th, law enforcement had gotten a number of reports of an unfamiliar white van in the area of the school bus route, both shortly before the kidnapping and during the week prior. There was no guarantee that the white van had anything to do with the incident, but Chowchilla was a small town. Unknown vehicles stood out like sore thumbs.
While the kidnappers slept, the bulletin went out on the CB radios to keep an eye out for suspicious white vans carrying children. In addition to law enforcement scouring the state, the long-distance truckers were also on the lookout.
This lead might have been useful had Fred, Jim, and Rick still been out on the road and not already safe back at Fred's apartment in San Francisco. Before they'd headed back to Fred's, they dropped the vans at a storage garage in San Jose, where no one would look for them.
Meanwhile, by early afternoon, Ed and the kids were waking up inside the buried truck, and things weren't going well. By the time they'd been in there for 12 hours, they'd gone through all the supplies, food, and water their captors had left for them.
As the hours ticked by, the hot summer sun baked the ground above their heads, their makeshift room, which had already been stuffy overnight, started to become stifling. This only made the stinky truck smell even more horrendous. The wheel wells had been cut out to be used as toilets, but the waste was sitting just below the truck. Its nausea-inducing scent was wafting back inside, mixing with the stench of sweat and body odor.
The lone candle lighting the space had long since burned out. To save the flashlight's batteries, Ed tried not to keep it on at all times, but the overwhelming darkness was terrifying for all of them. Some of the kids would start crying and panicking again whenever the light was off.
The other reason to keep the light on was to keep an eye on the unstable roof and sides of the buried truck. Although the kidnappers had reinforced the frame with a few wooden beams, they didn't seem especially sturdy.
And it didn't help that one of the anxious little boys had taken to kicking at the blocks, keeping the support beams in place. Whenever he did, the other kids would yell at him to stop, but their anger would only set off the already tense situation.
Ed tried to keep them under control, but he couldn't help but wonder what the point of keeping calm was. He had no idea if their captors were even going to come back, in which case, it wouldn't matter if they panicked or stayed calm. They'd die all the same.
He took a deep breath and found himself struggling. He was so tired. And then he suddenly realized he couldn't hear the fans anymore.
Even in the baking heat, Ed's blood ran cold. Without the fans bringing in fresh air, they would suffocate to death. And there was no one above to hear them screaming.
Coming up, as Ed and the kids fight for their lives, the entire country is looking for them.
Now, back to the story.
By the afternoon of Friday, July 16th, 1976, it had been more than 24 hours since Fred Woods, Jim Schoenfeld, and Rick Schoenfeld had pulled off their kidnapping. When they awoke from their restful slumber at Fred's parents' estate in San Francisco, they discovered that their perfect crime was already a national news story.
As the reality of the situation sunk in, Rick started to feel sick to his stomach. He couldn't be a part of this anymore. Around 5 p.m., he called his girlfriend to come pick him up at Fred's house.
As soon as she saw him, she knew something was wrong. He tried to keep his mouth shut, but he finally admitted to what he had done.
Rick's girlfriend immediately demanded he go and release the hostages, but Rick was a follower. He was too scared to go on his own. Fred and Jim had told him it was too dangerous to go back to the quarry now. After all, the whole state was looking for their captives.
The older two were also starting to realize the severity of the situation, but they were more concerned about themselves than their hostages. From what they could tell, the police and FBI still had no suspects. They decided to make a run for it while they still could. The bus driver and 26 children they'd buried alive would just have to fend for themselves in a small truck that was quickly running out of oxygen.
As late afternoon settled in, Ed and 14-year-old Mike Marshall realized they were all going to die if they didn't do something. Even though their captors could be waiting outside for all they knew, they had to try to escape.
They started by stacking as many of the mattresses and box springs as possible under the hole in the ceiling. That got them high enough to be able to push against the steel plate covering the hole. But the plate wouldn't budge.
It took some work, but they opened enough of a crack for Ed to reach an arm through.
Reaching around the top of the plate, Ed felt the pair of 100-pound industrial batteries that were weighing it down. Incredibly, he managed to move one of them with his one free arm while Mike held the plate wedged open. Together, they carefully lowered the batteries down into the truck.
Ed and Mike were relieved, but they couldn't help but notice that moving the plate didn't bring any fresh air into the truck. Something else must be blocking the way.
Once they were able to fully remove the steel plate, Ed and Mike saw the large plywood box that was covering the opening. The two of them climbed into it and tried to push the top off, but it wouldn't budge. Whatever was on the top of the box was even heavier than the 200-pound batteries.
Ed didn't know what to do. He was exhausted and emotionally drained. But Mike wasn't done trying. Buoyed by his teenage energy, he shoved the wooden beam into the top corner of the box, trying to lever it open. For a long moment, he strained, and then, out of nowhere, the top moved. Dirt spilled down onto them, and with it, sunlight and fresh air.
This restored Ed's energy. The two of them scrambled to push against the top of the box, but the dirt above it was too heavy. It must have been packed deep. As Ed and Mike started to tire, the younger children joined in the effort. But it was hot, tiring work. With little food in their stomachs, everyone was struggling. They were so close, and yet they couldn't seem to get past this final hurdle.
Ed felt his legs giving out. He collapsed onto the mattresses in a sweaty, sobbing mess. He couldn't believe that after all this effort, he had still failed.
Ed may have felt that he was completely exhausted, but in fact, that wasn't true. This limit prevents us from hurting ourselves and allows our bodies to keep strength and energy in reserve. But adrenaline rushes, often brought on by fight-or-flight situations, can help us push through the pain and tap into physical strength we didn't know was there.
This was an adrenaline-fueled situation, if there ever was one. Once Ed had caught his breath, he was able to climb back up through the hole and rejoin the kids. His newfound strength gave him the power to wrench off the top of the box. The plywood gave way. As the kids helped rip more pieces away, fresh air rushed in.
Once they had a big enough opening, one of the smaller kids peeked his head out and looked around. The coast was clear.
One by one, Ed and Mike lifted all 24 other kids out of the buried truck. Finally, they too climbed out, leaving their cage behind.
It was almost 8 p.m. on Friday, July 16th. They had been underground for 16 hours. They had no idea where they were, but wandering along the quarry's dirt road, Ed spotted a maintenance worker. He flagged him down for help, and within an hour, the police were at the quarry. Just like that, it was over. They were finally safe.
By the end of the night, all 27 were reunited with their families. But since none of them could identify their captors, it still took a few days for the police to hone in on their suspects. Since the hostages had been buried in a quarry owned by Fred's father, and Fred had a prior conviction for Grand Theft Auto, he quickly fell under suspicion. His two accomplices from that prior arrest, Jim and Rick, were natural choices for his co-conspirators. And once the police had flagged the three perpetrators, it didn't take much of a manhunt to catch them.
Shortly after the search began, Rick turned himself in. He already felt guilty enough. He couldn't stomach the thought of running.
Unlike Rick, his brother Jim had tried to run. But when he heard on the radio that Rick had turned himself in, Jim decided to do the same. Unfortunately, the police found him first. He was arrested before he could reach the station.
Fred made it the farthest of the three. He successfully escaped to Vancouver, Canada under an assumed name, but the Canadian authorities were cooperative with their American counterparts. Fred was arrested shortly after the Schoenfeld brothers were taken into custody.
The three young men were charged with kidnapping for ransom with bodily harm. They were convicted on all charges and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
However, in 1980, 4 years after the kidnapping, a different judge ruled that Rick, Jim, and Fred should not have been convicted of bodily harm. This reversal meant they were eligible for parole. As a result, Ed and the children had to appear at parole hearings every few years to testify about their experience. constantly forced to relive their trauma, the victims had trouble moving on with their lives.
Indeed, Ed and the kids would spend the ensuing decades haunted by the kidnapping. Many of the children channeled their anger at their kidnappers into self-destructive behavior. Some simply refused to ever talk about the ordeal, while others spent years trying to make sense of the randomness that had made them victims.
After spending over three decades behind bars, 57-year-old Rick Schoenfeld was released on parole in 2012. His brother Jim was released in 2015. Both had good records during their decades in prison and seemed to express sincere regret about the harm they had caused their captives. While some of the victims and their families claimed to forgive them, many believe both brothers should still be locked up. For them, it must be a small comfort that Fred Woods is still incarcerated as of 2019.
As for Ed Ray, their bus driver and protector, he passed away in 2012 at age 91. The children he'd protected continued to visit him throughout his life, and he was considered a local hero.
It was a recognition he deserved. But given the choice, Ed would have surely preferred not to have been forced to earn it. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other podcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite podcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Travis Clark, and Paul Liebeskind. This episode of Hostage was written by Kate Thorman, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.